This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, this is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart, and coming up in this Friday sporting edition, how the new link-up between Cricket Australia and Cricket Vanuatu promises to be a landmark connection.
We've seen PNG, the experience that they've gained playing in South Australia and in other places throughout Australia. And down the line, I think it's our chance to sort of catch up to our bigger sibling and hopefully run past them as well.
As Tahiti signs on the dotted line to host the Olympic surfing competitions in 2024, will Pacific Surfers make the cut?
For me, if we support them very well, then yeah, they can make it.
And as Papua New Guinea's best young male players prepare for an OFC Championship warm-up game in Brisbane, is enough being done to talent spot quality young PNG players based overseas?
In my current role now with Football Queensland in Far North Cairns, I see many of these players with PNG heritage up here. There needs to be these pathways that are created to go out and explore and find these players.
We'll hear more from PNG's all-time top scorer, Reggie Devani, later in the program. First, though, for the first time in more than 2 years, the PNG Hunters are back on home soil and are all set to play in front of their own fans at the National Football Stadium, but not without some last-minute drama when their opponents, Mackay Cutters, in what will be the final Queensland Cup match of the season for both teams, pulled out and refused to travel to Port Moresby over security concerns. There followed several hours of uncertainty, during which it appears Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese intervened personally. And then the Queensland Rugby League put out an early evening statement saying the game was back on. For the Hunters, it will be a special occasion, with most of the squad having never played for their team at the NFS before. And they'll be buoyed by the support of family and friends after many months apart during their COVID-enforced exile in Australia. The original plan was to go home 2 weeks ago, but security concerns then put pay to that idea after opponents Townsville Blackhawks blew the whistle, much to the irritation of Hunters head coach Matt Church. But when the team finally got the nod to head back to Moresby, they responded with a comprehensive win over ladder leaders Burley Bears to mark the farewell to their Gold Coast home away from home.
At the break, the Hunters were in front of Burley, 12 points to nil. Benji Cott extended the Hunters' advantage in the 47th minute. Wesa Tenza scored for the Hunters in the 52nd minute as they extended their lead. It was all the Hunters. Judah Rimbu with this try midway through the second half.
We were out there to make a point against the top team, Burley coming first in our competition and probably the best side that we've played all year. So we wanted to make a standpoint and we knew it was going to be our last game. You know, we got news on the Friday that we were going to be approved to come home this week. So we certainly wanted to finish off our time here on the Gold Coast with a good performance and got out to 32-0. We worked hard to get to that point and we were kind of out on our feet for the last 13 minutes or so and Burley got a few quick tries on us. So the boys are actually disappointed after the game. It was almost like we walked into a losing dressing shed.
But they got the win and I'm thinking there must have been a lot of adrenaline flowing because, as you say, you'd got the homecoming ticked off finally and the sense of relief must have been huge.
Yeah, definitely. Look, we had a bit of adversity prior to the Blackhawks game and we tried to use that motivation because, from my understanding, the Blackhawks had registered their concerns with the QRL about going back and that's what changed the circumstances for us to play that game down on the Gold Coast. So we certainly wanted to put in a good performance against the Blackhawks and then finish our time strongly and I felt like we did that as a group.
The view from the PNG RFL seemed to be that perhaps that they felt the QRL were being a bit overcautious. Do you have an opinion on that?
Oh, look, I think player safety is paramount. My personal take on it was I think my guys have sacrificed enough. You know, I felt like opposition teams could sacrifice 36 hours being under security detail to ensure their safety, but I don't make those decisions, so we just have to roll with the punches. And yeah, look, I think anyone that knows PNG knows that rugby league, if anything, was going to calm some situations, and I felt like probably the opposition opposition teams. Their only danger was getting hit up for gear from the public.
I was talking not so very long ago now to the Warriors on their return to New Zealand after being in exile for a long period of time playing in the NRL, of course. And the suggestion was there will be a lot of emotion for those players walking out onto their home ground, in some cases for the first time. And it's going to be the same for the Hunters, isn't it? Most of your players have never actually had the chance to play in front of their own fans.
Yeah, we've got a squad of 27 players that we brought down to the Gold Coast, and only seven of those had actually played NFS as a Hunter before. So the majority of our squad are new to the Hunters in the last 2 years, and we haven't had any home games in the last 3 years. So, yeah, look, it's a tremendous experience for everyone to represent, I guess, the nation's club. So we represent all of PNG, and it's just going to be so good to be home, back where we belong, in front of Papua New Guineans.
And I guess a last chance to try and get noticed and be in the running for selection for the World Cup.
Yeah, look, there's a number of guys that are probably on that fringe, and some performances probably have not helped in terms of that. But, you know, we've competed well in our last two games, and if we can do that again for a third game at home, it'll bode well towards selections for the PM13 and then hopefully for the Kumuls World Cup program.
So you're about to play the first home game in a number of years. For you personally, as head coach, I mean, can you sum up what the experience the last couple of years has been like for you and the squad in Australia? I mean, I assume there's been good and bad in terms of what you've learned about your players.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, each day it's a constant battle to find out, I guess, where your players are at personally, because I felt like the two-year experience, at times they're either in one of three buckets, you know, loving life in Australia, or the missing home, or nonplussed. So working out who's in which bucket on what day has been the challenge for me personally. You know, I'm so proud that we've managed to come down here, and yes, we would like better results, but I think that the personal development in each and every individual within the organisation is going to stand them in good stead for the rest of their careers. You know, our goal at the Hunters is to make NRL players, so hopefully this transition over the last 2 years benefits them in that, and, you know, the next guy that goes to the NRL hopefully has that adjusted to Australian life and has had that experience under their belt to step forward into that opportunity.
Okay, well, I wish you well on the return to Port Moresby. And as you say, for most of the players, first chance to play that home game. Just one other thing I was going to ask you on a related issue. There are rumours flying around about the possibility of a Fijian team coming into the QRL. Have you heard anything to that effect?
I haven't personally, no. I know that there's been some discussion around what the state cups look like, around Peter Berlandis' view of having a national reserve grade competition. But at the moment, that's all discussion, and I haven't personally heard anything about Fiji into the Queensland Rugby League. But having had this experience, I know that they're wonderful people and wonderful athletes. And, you know, I think we need to be doing more as a game through the Pacific, because that's where our participation numbers are going to continue to grow and foster NRL players.
Matt Church, head coach of the PNG Hunters, now back on home soil at last and gearing up for a big performance in front of their own fans at the NFS against the Mackay Cutters tomorrow afternoon. Now we know the Cutters are going to be there, although I strongly suspect the PNG fans won't believe it till the plane actually touches down at Port Moresby. But let's hope that game goes ahead without further interruption. And on that question of whether a Fijian team might be being set up to compete in the Queensland Cup, we already have one, of course, in the New South Wales competition, the Ron Massey Cup. With pretty strong rumours about that story. We're chasing them down here at Pacific Beat, and we'll bring you more as and when we can. Now, on the show last week, we told you about the new Australia-Pacific Cricket Linkages Program, which is being funded by the Australian Government's Pacific Oz Sports Organisation. The aim, to develop the game in both Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu by giving both countries access to Australian competitions. For PNG, it means building on established links with the men's team, the Barramundis, already involved in the top-end T20 tournament in the Northern Territory, amongst others. But for Vanuatu, the new initiative is a landmark which will open doors for their men's and women's teams. Cricket Vanuatu's chief executive, Tim Cutler, says it takes their relationship with Cricket Australia to a whole new level, with the promise of more high-quality competition and the chance to close the gap on PNG as the leading Pacific cricket nation.
There's been individual relationships with clubs, associations and states in the past, but nothing as formalised as here and nothing to the level of support from a financial but also an exposure point of view that we're going to get through this.
You mentioned individuals there, and certainly the current captain of the men's team, for example, Patrick Matatava, has played club cricket at the top level here in Melbourne for the Essendon Club, and a number of other players have had similar contracts. But Vanuatu as a team has never had the kind of opportunity that this link will actually provide, both for men and for women.
No, and I think it's evident from the on-field performances in Canada just gone how much our men's team could benefit from more opportunity like this for them to play high-level cricket as a team, whether it's home or away. And we're hoping that this support via Cricket Australia, and more importantly, probably considering the funding is coming via the Australian government, Pacific Oz Sports, what that could mean from the men's team development, and hoping this is the start of a great relationship with that program and with Cricket Australia, and likewise with our women down the line as well.
So would I be right in thinking that what this will mean in one case is the opportunity to take part in, for example, the top-end T20 tournament, which is on at the moment? Papua New Guinea are already involved in that. So would I be right in thinking that Vanuatu would take part in that and you could play Papua New Guinea as part of that process?
Yes, it's a great initiative. Cricket 365, as they call it, and it's an array of tournaments with the top-end T20 being one of them. Not telling any state secrets here, but we'd actually put feelers out to NT Cricket about us being part of that this year as well. It was just too late, and also from a funding point of view, we would have had to have seen where that comes from. But yeah, we've seen PNG, the big sibling in the region anyway, but the experience that they've gained both playing in South Australia and in other places throughout Australia are now formalised with participation in that top-end competition. I'd love for our men's team, I guess in this case, we're talking about being part of it, but also our women's team down the line. And I think it's our chance then to sort of catch up to our bigger sibling and hopefully run past them as well.
Great opportunities clearly for the players, but what about the admin side of things, the coaching side of things? Are there gaps there perhaps that this deal doesn't necessarily assist you with?
Yes, I think the tyranny of distance and expense for anyone in the Pacific is always a huge challenge when you come to prioritising decisions like this, and especially if it's your money or indeed you're applying for money that comes from a funding pot like Pacific Oz Sports. It's very focused to elite on-field development. We've been very lucky to be supported by Australia's Team Up program, formerly Pacific Sports Partnerships. I know there are lots of Pacifics and sports here, but hopefully you can keep up with me. But the Team Up funding has really hit at social impact programs around our Women's Island Cricket and our Appeal Against Violence program that sits alongside our school development program, and where this announcement, which is amazing, the experience to have the Australian Indigenous sides tour Vanuatu, there is still important things around skill development, coaching and sports administration. As unfashionable as that sounds, to have those skill sets built and assisting sport, specifically cricket, the Pacific, would be amazing. And hopefully that's something down the line that we can explore more so, whether it's with the partners coming via with Australia funding Cricket Australia or its states, or indeed we've also got another very successful full member in New Zealand in the region as well, who we have similar provincial relationships, but that will hopefully build more and more as the region comes close together with perhaps something directly with New Zealand cricket, similar to what we're talking about here.
And would it be fair to say that the eyes are on the prize for Vanuatu in terms of bridging the gap between yourselves and Papua New Guinea? I mean, clearly you feel you have the talent in the country. It's really opportunities like this that will perhaps allow that talent to blossom, and maybe you'll be up there with PNG in the not too distant future.
We can only hope. We can only do the preparation that we can. But no, it'd be lying to say that if we weren't looking at PNG as a target in the region, and as everybody else, I think, from East Asia, from as far as Korea, Japan, Indonesia, Philippines, to us in the Pacific, of seeing who we have to beat. And even more so recently with the fact that the ICC has revised the qualification pathways to mean that there is direct regional qualification, you know, a bit more like a FIFA World Cup, that there are a certain number of places per region rather than in the previous iterations where you would then go into a global qualifier and come up against the best teams around the world. You could say that East Asia Pacific now has a, I'm air quoting here, an easier path in that there's a guaranteed spot for the winner of that regional final, similar to what is there for the under-19s men's and women's World Cups for the last 10 years or so. But that really puts even more onus on these regional qualifiers that are coming up, that Vanuatu will be hosting the Pacific one in 2 and a bit weeks' time, but makes it all the more important to build those capabilities with men's and women's teams, knowing that there's a clearer, simpler road to get to the T20 World Cups. And we've seen the ICC talk about T20 cricket being the growth vehicle and being what they're trying to use is going to grow the game. So hopefully with that comes investment and exposure and the chance for our men's team to be getting through to the 2024 T20 World Cup in West Indies, and for the first time, the United States as well. And the opportunity that brings, and the fact that we're not going to be going into a first round like is happening in the Men's World Cups at the moment, be going into a group with four other probably higher ranked teams, three of which are going to be some of the big four members. So you could be falling into a group with India, Australia, or New Zealand from the go. So the exposure that that could bring along this new pathway to T20 cricket, I guess, brings the importance of these partnerships and the building of our players on and off the field all the more to the fore, seeing how the World Cups are structured now.
And the first stage of that World Cup qualification process will be hosted in the East Asia Pacific region by Vanuatu next month, in fact, and in a world first, that tournament will be played on a hybrid wicket. That's never been done before, so that could be a big step forward for the associate nations as well. That's Tim Cutler, Chief Executive of Cricket Vanuatu. Let's take a look at some of the stories making headlines across the Pacific this morning. And Carl Evans is with me. And first off, Carl, the political problems in Vanuatu. What's the latest?
That's right. So the first court hearing into the government's controversial move to dissolve parliament will be held on September 2, which is next Friday. So that's according to the Vanuatu Daily Post. And it follows an urgent application filed by the 27 now former members of parliament after they were effectively dismissed when the country's president approved a request by the PM Bob Loughman to dissolve parliament just right before he was set to face a vote of no confidence. So the former opposition leader, Ralph Reganvanu, who was on the show this week, said this case will be the first of its kind in the sense that the session of parliament was apparently already underway when the dissolution was sought.
So this time next week, the court will get down to it. It'll be interesting to see how long they take to come up with a decision, with, of course, the possibility of an election pending. Now, to Fiji, of course, COVID has been a big problem in Fiji, as it has around most of the rest of the Pacific over the last couple of years. But this time we're talking about AIDS-related deaths. What's the problem
here? Yeah, and it isn't something that you hear a ton about these days, which is really surprising. But Fiji so has recorded a 173% increase in AIDS-related deaths from 2010 to 2021 and was among 38 countries listed with an alarming climbing infection rate. So this was reported by the Fiji Times this morning on page 3, and they were citing the latest figures from the UN AIDS Global Health Update. More worrying, though, the update estimates Fiji has about 1,400 people living with HIV, and only just over half of them actually know their status, and only 45% were actually receiving antiviral treatment as well. So the agency has urged the Fiji government to see these figures as a bit of a wake-up call and a national call to action and to basically avoid complacency.
Does rather suggest that the education message hasn't got through too, which may be something the government may care to take a look at. Now, the Cook Islands tourism sector, they reopened not so very long ago, but they haven't got enough tourists. They want more flights.
that's right, Richard. Yeah, so Cook Islands business leaders were told by the Cook Islands Tourism Corporation on Tuesday that talks about more flights are taking place. So this is reported by RNZ New Zealand, and it follows calls from the tourist sector to implement direct flights to Waratonga from Sydney and Los Angeles. They say they can't just rely on flights from New Zealand anymore, and they're going to need some more help if they're going to recover from COVID. So Managing Director of Castaway Resort, Paul Ash, he was quoted in the story and said that they're going to need at least one Boeing 777 to arrive once a fortnight. He also said businesses may need a wage subsidy to get them through the off-peak months if nothing changes soon.
Yeah, so flights out of Sydney, I can see, out of Los Angeles to Cook Islands, full flights. I don't know. Would there be enough interest?
It does sound a little bit ambitious, but the Cook Islands, from what pictures I've seen, is a beautiful place.
Oh, no doubt about that. I'm just wondering whether they could fill enough planes with Americans to get them there.
Probably don't know where the Cook Islands is, a lot of Americans.
Well, yes, I wouldn't like to comment on that, but I suspect you're probably right. Carl, thanks very much indeed. Carl Evans there with some of the stories that are making news headlines around the Pacific this morning. And another story that is certainly making headlines, that concerns foreign journalists, and I suspect particularly Australian journalists, who may soon be persona non grata in Solomon Islands as the government retaliates to the investigation by the ABC's Four Corners TV current affairs show into the country's ties or not with China. The ban was foreshadowed in a lengthy prime ministerial statement accusing the ABC of spreading misinformation and promoting racism. But as John Daly reports, it's not exactly clear how or when this ban on journalists might come into force.
Four Corners' investigation of China's growing power in Solomon Islands has drawn the ire of the head of government.
What's wrong with photographing that? Are you...
not allowed. I say again.
Prime Minister Manase Sogavare's office issued a statement accusing the ABC of spreading misinformation to turn Solomon Islanders against bilateral ties with China, a claim the ABC denies. Ruth Lilagula heads Transparency International's Honiara branch and featured in the episode.
He has failed, or those around him, they have failed to do their own work to really respond to what is being raised by the Four Corners and also his own citizens in the country. We are not against China. We are against the manner in which our government conducts its relationship with the Communist Party of China. That's what is not agreeable to us.
The Prime Minister's statement says the ABC is promoting racism by criticising Solomon Islands government for partnering with non-whites. It's also the basis for the threat to ban foreign journalists and media organisations, allegedly breaching the country's constitutional protection from racial discrimination. Dan McGarry is a Vanuatu-based journalist and one of the founding members of the Melanesian Media Freedom Forum. He's unconvinced by accusations of racism.
I think they're spurious, frankly. I don't see any merit to that. Accusations, you know, this kind of application of race as a defense tends to overlook the substantive claims made by ABC piece. And none of those were actually addressed in any material way.
Dan McGarry says Solomon Islands government has regulatory measures to ban foreign media.
He could create a blacklist of sorts, you know, basically say that this person or that person is no longer welcome within the country, or he could put additional requirements on media professionals, you know, working within the borders of Solomon Islands. We've seen that kind of approach taken by the government of Nauru, for example, where they placed significant restrictions on media professionals seeking to enter into the country. They raised the rate, the visa cost to an exorbitant amount, and in fact, an exclusionary amount.
Shailendra Singh is the Fiji-based head of journalism at the University of the South Pacific. He says media scrutiny can be fraught in Solomon Islands and other Pacific countries.
Many Solomon Islanders seem to support the report. They think that it's truthful. And of course, the truth must come out. But, you know, in this context, in the Solomon Islands context, the question is at what cost, right? Because as the Prime Minister said, you have to agree, the Solomon Islands is still fragile, right? So these are the dilemmas of journalism in Pacific Island countries. And the geopolitical contest has made the situation even more complex, as Four Corners is finding out.
The government's threat to bar foreign press follows censorship of the country's public broadcaster.
That report's from John Daly.
ABC Radio Australia is your home for rugby league in the Pacific.
Watch out!
Sunday, West take on St George at 2.
Dummy straightens, gets into the in goal,
and he goes in to score.
Then the Gold Coast clash with Newcastle at 4.
They can't believe it either. It's pandemonium.
All the action right here. This Sunday from 2 PNG time.
Right here.
On ABC Radio Australia, your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
Nice footy.
You're listening to the Friday morning sporting edition of Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt. And less than a month after she led Papua New Guinea to the OFC Women's Championship and earned the team a place in next year's Intercontinental World Cup qualification playoffs, it appears the team's English coach, Nicola Demain, may not be in the role for much longer. To tell us more, we're joined by the president of the Papua New Guinea Football Association, John Caponato, who joins us on the line from Fiji this morning. In fact, good morning. Welcome to Pacific Beat.
Yeah, good morning, Richard. Good morning.
So tell me, what is the situation here? I mean, Nicola Demain has done something that no coach has ever done before for the PNG women's team. She's under contract until November, but what I'm being told is you don't, as an FA, plan to renew it despite her success. So if that's the case, why?
Yeah, those are challenging questions all throughout the media and all throughout the fraternity of football. I mean, we have two stages. Let's look at it this way. We've got two stages. One is the stage one in the Oceania challenge as an Asian Cup to the intercontinental playoff. We've got a second stage which we need to prepare much above higher than what we've come through, and preparing the players for the next stage, which is playing against countries in the next, in the other confederations that are much higher than us. Therefore, as a federation, with in collaboration with the Oceania Football, in assessing what our girls have gone through, remember, in the last five Pacific gold medals were all won by Papua New Guinea coaches. And this is no difference, because New Zealand was direct entry into the World Cup. So somehow we invited a coach overseas to, you know, come in and also assist with our national coaches. So we as a federation, in collaboration with OFC, sees that we need someone higher to take us to the next stage, which is stage two, and in preparing our girls. And we love, with a lot of critics from assessment from OFC, which is our parent body, Oceania Football Confederation's technical department, that we need to look at someone higher who can carry our girls forward. So that's the basic reason that we're not terminating here, but we're just ceasing the contract, which is only 2 months away.
But what is interesting is in the comments I've seen attributed to Nicola Demain is she says that she has the highest coaching qualification that it's possible to have. So therefore, who would you get that will be better qualified? Or is this more about reputation and perhaps past success elsewhere in the world that you're looking for?
That's right. I mean, look, Nicola's done well. I mean, she's trying to put things in place. But as tech, we need to listen to our technical advisors who are very sharp in the areas of structural football. I mean, and that's what we've been liaising with Oceania Football in trying to help us to get to the next stage. For Nicola, she's done well. I mean, that's a legacy. That's an achievement she's done in the Nations Cup. Now, we basically want to look in collaboration with OFC and FIFA, if there's advices on someone who's coaching in the next level of, you know, above. I mean, she has the credential, but she hasn't done the experience in the States too or in other confederations. That's where we're trying to bring expertise. Now, look at Vanuatu in 2010 in the under 20, which they were very successful because they followed the same thing that they've done, just like what we're trying to do with our women now. So that's what we're trying to do. So our management is sitting down with her and explaining to her, your contract ends in November. We're just ceasing it. We're not terminating it. But we may call for some other involvement. That's the prerogative of the FA.
But my understanding also is that the communication between the PNG FA and Nicola Demain, based, I admit, on what's been reported in the local media, hasn't been too good. I mean, she says, she's quoted as saying she's sought a meeting with you and hasn't had that meeting yet.
Well, you know, I mean, those, you know, situations behind it. But I leave that to my management, you know, to make the, to sit down with her on the round table and explain what is done, and so that we are executing and we're ceasing the contract. So we have to go forward, I mean, in consultation with our partners.
And to come back to the OFC's role in this, I mean, to some extent, are you allowing the OFC, not to dictate, that's too strong a word, but certainly to highly recommend that as an FA you make this change?
Yes, I don't want to say they're dictating us. I mean, I think that's not a good vocabulary there. But I think what we're doing in collaboration is assessing the situation and collectively says, okay, we FA, we're going to do that. What do you think? Do you have any options that we can bring into our football that can take our women to the next level? We need weight of a coach that could take us there. So in collaboration, we don't forget, PNG is not representing only PNG. We're now representing the 10 countries, excluding New Zealand. We represent the Oceania region. So we need to perform better above in the next level. We need to see good structure of football. I mean, Richard, Papua New Guinea's DNA is in their own strength and the ability and the will and the mind they have. We lack for the last 16 years of structural football in Papua New Guinea. That's the whole idea when I came into football, is to introduce more coaching at a very high level and referees. We've been spending no time in developing in the last 16 years. Our record now proves that we are now developing our referees and we're now getting into our coaches to get to the next level.
So do you have a coach in mind to take over and lead the women's team to the World Cup qualifier? And would it necessarily be a female coach? I mean, clearly, for example, the Australian women's team is coached by a male coach. I mean, is that a concern? Would you prefer to have a female or a male, or just the best available?
I mean, best available, Richard. I mean, we're in collaboration right now. I mean, our technical department is liaising with OFC and discussing the best options, the recommendation that they give, that we think we can see a bit of change, a bit of improvement in our girls' performance. I mean, they've done well, but I think there's some room for improvement, and that's what we want to see.
So
it's either female or male, which could take our girl to the next level. I think that's what we're looking for.
So you are of the belief that the team has the talent to come through this World Cup qualifier, but at the moment, despite winning the OFC Championship for the first time, that the feeling is from yourselves and from OFC that they're not getting the right guidance?
I mean, I'm not a coach. Richard, I'm not a coach and all that, but I've been in football for quite a long time. And I've seen that football in PNG, we've played our own style of football. Now, the world of football is changing. The tactical, the structures, the understanding of players. I mean, for me, as an intelligent person on the point of view looking, I think we need something more. We need a structural play that our girls can understand. Well, some of these girls, maybe 60% of them, have come from the Pacific Games right through. We're now trying to build a new breed of players for the next Pacific Games to 2026 with a new renewed mind of understanding structural football and formations. That's the challenge I face today going forward for 2026. So, I mean, it's out there. We just need to find someone to take us to the Stage 2, the completion of the Stage 2.
Okay, and one other thing I'd like to ask you, I mean, going back a couple of years, the process of looking into the establishment of professional soccer leagues in various Pacific countries,
yes,
including your own Papua New Guinea,
yes,
that process began. COVID clearly has got in the way. I mean, is this still a live idea for the Pacific? Are we going to see professional men's leagues in the first instance in the next year or two?
Yeah, Richard, as you know, I am the chairman of the Oceania Professional League. We started 3 years. We are about 90% completed. 2023 December, we're going to launch the OFC Pro League, and by 24 March is the first match to kick off. So we're on track. We're doing a lot of awareness. We're now trying to complete the prospectus of the Oceania Pro League, and we're waiting for our ESCO meeting coming in October, our Congress, and then I'll be doing the roadshow hopefully next year, traveling through the Pacific to try and promote the Pro League. So it's still alive and well.
And besides your own country, Papua New Guinea, how many others will be involved at this stage? I mean, have any fallen by the wayside because of the problems with COVID?
Well, COVID is a challenge, and we all have to take challenge as we go along and how we strategize, how we plan, how we move forward. So Papua New Guinea is going to, we're proposing 8 clubs to each country to have 1 pro league each. So we just don't know about New Zealand, whether they're going to participate or not. That's something that we are still working with them. But each country is going to have a pro league, and we have 2 system structure of football, whether we go the conventional way or whether we go for the second series way. As you know, Oceania is divided by waters, and we just want to look at a easy, a convenient structure of pro leagues so that we could have that in our region.
So that's all coming up in 2024, fingers crossed, no more pandemics.
Well, Richard, I'm crossing my fingers, and during the COVID, 3 years of COVID, we've been working tirelessly, sleepless days, trying to get this structure, trying to get this Pro League going. We have the blessing of FIFA, which is a plus on us, and we got to believe in what we believe for, and I think the talents in the Oceania, in the island nations, are yet to be exposed at its highest. And so I'm behind this.
All right. We'll look forward to that with great interest, of course, those who follow the world game around the Pacific. John, thank you so much for joining us on Pacific Beat this morning. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you.
John Caponato, president of the Papua New Guinea Football Association and also very much involved in that committee that's looking at establishing a professional men's leagues around the Pacific. It's been a long time coming. Looks like it's going to happen, but unfortunately for Nicola Domain, it looks like she won't be coaching the PNG women's team at the World Cup qualification playoffs next year. I mean, how good a job do you have to do to progress? But you heard the explanation there from the PNG FA president, John Caponato. Now, official papers have been signed ratifying Tahiti as host of the Olympic surfing competitions at the 2024 Games. The three documents signed by French Polynesia's President Edouard Fritch will deliver infrastructure needed to stage the event, as well as passage of the Olympic flame, which is going to have to travel a long way, isn't it? Now, as Kyle Evans reports, Pacific surfers are setting their sights on being there and giving themselves a chance to make waves, literally, I guess, on home territory.
While Paris will be the host city for the Olympic Games in 2024, the surfing events will take place on the other side of the world at Chiuppo in Tahiti. Now Pacific surfers have their sights on qualification in the hope of competing for medals on their own doorstep. Ian Portingale, who was Fiji's national surfing coach until his retirement 2 years ago, expects a number of Pacific names to be in the mix.
When they select those who can compete, they use the top 10 male on the WSL event and the top 8 females and then the 2 from the host of Tahiti, or they may even go to 2 hosts from France. And then the other 20 surfers have to qualify through the ISA World Games. I'm not sure where they are next year, but that's probably one of the key things to get to and finish up in the semi-finals or higher to get to Chiapas.
The ISA World Surfing Games to be held in El Salvador next year will serve as the main qualification stage for the Olympics. Portingale, who still works as advisor to the Fiji Surfing Association, says the incentive of an Olympic berth will make that event much tougher than in the past.
It's the best from each country. Last time I went, there was 110 countries represented. So obviously it's quite a big event and it's the best from each of the countries. So, you know, there are no easy heats. You have to be on your game right from the get-go. And some people miss out by 0.1 of a point. Others get through by 0.1 of a point. So it'll be a very tough competition.
Young Tahitian Kauli Vaas will be among them after recently defeating the veteran US star Kelly Slater on his way to claiming runners-up spot at the Tahiti Pro. However, top Fijian surfer Hannah Bennett has ruled herself out of Olympic qualification, as is her countryman Inia Nakalivu, who competed at the ISA Games in 2019.
At the moment, I'm not really into competition mode, just focusing on another path, like just doing my business, try to like make it grow and hopefully doing what I want to do, you know, like helping the locals, especially for those who stuck in the village community. You know, I'm in a different mode at the moment. No more competitions.
Instead, Inia says he will look to develop promising youngsters Api Tabinaliva and John Vasia.
Those are the two best Fijian I'm looking up to. That's Api and John. For me, if we support them very well, then yeah, they can make it.
But it's the challenges out of the water that could prove to be the biggest obstacles. Ian Portingale says funding to support Pacific surfers, particularly in Fiji, is hard to come by.
Obviously, rugby get the bulk of it, and the only real big female sport is the female rugby or female netball. So they kind of stand pretty close to what money comes for rugby. And then all the other sports of swimming, badminton, boxing and all those, and then way down the bottom is surfing. So I think to get a good amount of funding, there's going to have to require significant push from the association over there to lobby some extra money or find a sponsor of the team.
Bart Porto, as he's known in the surfing world, says for those who make it to the Olympics at Chiuppo, it will be an unforgettable experience.
It gets thicker. The wall of the wave actually gets thicker. So whilst it does gain in height, it's the depth of the wave that creates all that power and damage. But Yeah, it's a pretty incredible wave. And obviously once it's overhead high, they've got to have a big pair of guts to paddle into it and take the drop. I think those who go to it will, once they get over the initial fear and take a few drops, I think it'll be pretty high scoring, yeah.
Former national surfing coach in Fiji, Ian Portingale, and before that, for many years involved in surfing here in Australia. And it'd be nice to see some of his prodigies perhaps make the Olympic event in Tahiti 2024. And the reporter there was Kyle Evans.
Love sport? Tune in to Can You Be More Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halatau.
What was the most important thing to you as an athlete when you were considering an offer?
Getting one is the first one. Getting an offer to stay somewhere. I was lucky enough to play for 14 seasons. Not everyone gets to do that.
14 seasons? You're a veteran, man.
Old person, yeah.
Can you sign my boots?
Can You Be More Pacific? Thursday night, 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Very good morning to you. If you're just joining us, see you with Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. It's the Friday morning sporting edition. We were talking a little earlier about Papua New Guinea's women's soccer team and machinations of a new coach coming in, Rupia. Focus now on the national under-19 men's team from PNG, who are stepping up their preparations for the OFC Championship in Tahiti next month, with a trip to Brisbane to play Redlands United, newly promoted to the second-tier Queensland Premier League. The game has largely come about because United feature midfielder Lee Nabo-Font in their team. Born and bred in Leh, he's been called into the PNG squad for the OFC tournament.
I was in the system already in the under-16 World Cup qualifiers, the junior squad there. That was back in 2018. So yeah, tournament was coming up again. I knew there was an under-19 one, so playing over here, and I was trying to prepare myself for it just in case I get any call up again. So great for the opportunity to be up again in September.
So who are you going to play for in this game? For Redlands or for PNG?
I'll be playing for Papua New Guinea.
That's going to be strange, isn't it, to be playing for PNG against your teammate?
Yeah, exactly. All this year I've been sharing the field with them, and then to be going up against them, it could be like, obviously I know how they play, so I could counter that.
United's head coach Graham Harvey says Lee has been instrumental in making the game against Papua New Guinea happen.
Really through Lee himself and his father. They just reached out to us as a club and said that they were travelling over. I've got some connections through PNG as well. So, yeah, we've kind of got that link through them, really.
And so in terms of how the whole thing's been put together, I mean, this is going to be the PNG under-19s against the Redlands first team. Is that the idea, or would it be a chance for you to try out a few players as well?
It'll be a chance to try a few players, yeah. It'll be a mixture of our first team and some of our younger players as well.
Lee Nabo-Font is confident that once the PNG team arrives in Tahiti, they can make an impact on a group that includes Fiji, Tonga and the host nation. And he says seeing Pacific players make some impact on football in Australia recently, like Vanuatu's captain Brian Kaltak and PNG senior international Tommy Semi, is great motivation.
We could make some noise this tournament. All the boys, young, talented boys, I mean, they're all very attacking-minded, creative footballers, so I'm extremely looking forward to this tournament coming up. You know, seeing players like, especially Tommy Semi, being Papua New Guinean as well, and seeing what he's doing, and, you know, it's just the inspiration to players like me and other Pacific Islander players as well.
You know, it's the biggest honour in football, I think, to play for your country. So for him to get that opportunity, I think it's something that should excite him. I hope the PNG squad have had a good preparation leading into the tournament so that they can go and perform against the other island nations. And Lee's had a good year here at Redlands. I'm not aware that he's gone over to PNG for any camps, but I'm assuming that's what they're doing coming to Brisbane.
A sign there, perhaps, though, that communication with the PNG FA is not as good as it might be. And former international and his country's all-time top goal scorer, Reggie Devani, says that's a situation that needs to change.
An international department within the FA needs to be created where you're able to go and scout these players and make connections with clubs abroad so you can keep tabs on players, because there's potential for talent identification outside of the country. So PNG, in this case, with Lee, he's another example of many young Papua New Guineans with family moving abroad, had the opportunity to get football development in a country like Australia, and eventually now playing in the NPL space. Some are in A-League environments, academy environments as well. In my current role now with Football Queensland in Far North, Cairns, I see many of these players with PNG heritage up here. There needs to be these pathways that are created to go out and explore and find these players, because it's an opportunity for the country's national teams to evolve and develop, bringing in players with international experience and exposure.
If I'm being brutally honest, we don't have had much to do with the PNG sides. No one really makes contact with us from there. Probably missing a trick, really. The connection is there through Reggie. He's working up in Cairns as a development officer for Football Queensland. He should be tapped into a lot more, to be honest. I've done some work out in PNG before, but there's not much coming back, if I'm honest, from the PNG FA. But other island nations like Solomons, Fiji, very proactive. We have good relationships with those guys.
So based on Graham Harvey's experience, plenty for the PNG FA to work on, perhaps, if they want to make the most of overseas talent. But in the meantime, Reggie Devaney says the game against Redlands on Monday night will be an important stepping stone for the young PNG squad.
One thing that I have seen and experienced was in the coaching setup and the player as well, but more so seeing it when I was in the coaching setup with PNG FA. Now, some players, it's their first time to travel abroad, first time they ever have a passport, first time to get on a plane, first time to play under lights. It's not just the football side of it. It'll be all those different experiences, the culture, all happening at once. It's a great opportunity for those kids to play against a team in Australia. They will definitely learn a lot. The coaching staff will definitely learn a lot from what they're normally used to facing. And if a player does well, I know guys like Graham, Harvey, they're always looking for talent. So if a kid does stand out in this friendly, you never know what can happen.
Reggie Devaney, capped 17 times for the PNG national team, scored 13 goals. That makes him the all-time top goal scorer for that team. He's also been assistant manager of the national men's team in the past, so certainly knows what he's talking about. Redlands United, the PNG under-19s, they'll play them in Brisbane on Monday night. Final round of the World Rugby Men's Series in Los Angeles over the weekend, and Fiji could still be in with a chance of winning the title because their two worst results, each of the team's two worst results, will be dropped from the final standings. So without doing the maths, Fiji could still be in with a shout. They're in Pool C with Ireland, France and Wales in Los Angeles. Samoa there too. They've been going pretty well with their young team. They're up against England, Scotland and Kenya. So fingers crossed for Fiji and indeed for Samoa to do well over there in California. And that rounds out this edition of the Friday Sporting Edition of Pacific Beat. Jordan Fennell will be along with the afternoon edition at 3:05 PNG time this afternoon. You can catch up with some of the big stories of the week in Pacific Review at various times over the weekend. And then Pacific Beat returns on Monday morning, 6:05 PNG time, with your regular host, Priyanka Srinivasan. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thanks for your company. Have a great sporting weekend.